Thank you. Thank you, Ben. You have a leader who has a very warm and gentle personality and affirming character. Thank you for that. And it's good to have you as our leader here to be a good model in that regard. Well, it is good for Judy and myself to be with you. I enjoyed yesterday. When we're in the country, we're engaged in churches such as we are with you this weekend. And it's always a joy. In fact, I was at a conference on Thursday and I was being interviewed. And the last question was, what event gives you, what are the one of the occasions that gives you greater pleasure than others? And I said, it's when I meet with like-minded Christians who are interested in encountering God, in exploring the Word. And we enjoyed that yesterday. And we're going to do the same today. When we explore the role of the Spirit in our lives, just taking over the theme from yesterday. One of the interesting things about this building that you're in is what confronts you, what welcomes you when you come in to it with all the affirmatory comments that the pupils are intended to take on board and us as well. And I want to do much the same with you. I want to affirm you. I want to encourage you. But I'm going to do it through the eyes of Paul, who speaks about the Spirit's role in our lives in ways that make us want to sit back and take it in because it sounds too good to be true. For many Christians, we have thought of the Spirit not just as the third member of the Trinity and therefore less important than the Father and the Son, which is not true, but it's what we have been brought up to assume is truth. But also, we have grown up to the notion that the Spirit doesn't have that much to do with our lives or with us, not unless we're particularly special as Christians. But for the rest of us, it's only once in a blue moon he turns up and does something. And it might not last very long, but it's something. And then he's off again on the other side of the universe. And with a better luck, touch wood, he might do something in our lives sometime before we go to heaven, which is the furthest from the truth that you could imagine. And when you read the New Testament, you find the Spirit's commitment to us is just remarkable. So we're just going to dip into a couple of verses to make that point. In fact, the books that Ben referred to, they are written with the same motivation to affirm you. And it's not a difficult task because they tend to be written about the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And fundamentally, as far as we're concerned as people, their motivation, each of them, is to affirm us, to empower us, to make us feel safe, to do us good, to be our best friends. And so the number of books there, I encourage you to have a look at them because they will give you the opportunity not just to explore the members of the Godhead and so that you will know more about them than you did, but you will become more appreciative of their determination to encounter us in ways that do us good. And we don't have to even achieve a certain level of spirituality before that happens. They've done it from the moment we become Christians. So you will see that there's a number of books there on the Spirit related to our theme. There's a DVD series on the Spirit. Ben's mentioned the booklet, The Remarkable Spirit, which covers what we were doing yesterday. We'll cover what we're doing today, so you feel free to nod off because you can buy the booklet and have a little rest in these next half hour. And there'll be more in there as well. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about. And, well, I'm going to be looking at a verse in the book of Galatians. Let me give you the context for what Paul says in this letter. This letter, by the way, is probably the first letter to have been written. So it comes before the Gospels are written. You might say, well, who cares? The value of knowing that it was the first book to be written is that it tells you something about that which was important to the writer and the readers, that this should be the first topic that's covered. And what Paul does, because he's the writer, and he's only got 6 chapters in this book, the first 2 chapters, he makes a plea for why the people ought to listen to what he's going to be saying to them. And he takes 2 chapters for that, which is a third of the book. In other words, why are you spending so much time encouraging the readers to be prepared for what you have to say? Is it that important, Paul? And Paul's response is, it's absolutely that important. Because what he's going to be talking about is the fact that the Spirit who's been given by Jesus to the church, that's you and me, and who comes into our lives the minute we become Christians, he is there to be our best friend, our best guide, the best that we could imagine anybody could be, and then a bit more. And the people to whom Paul is writing have no idea that they have been in the presence of such a person, although they're Christians, and it's shockingly wonderful for them. Let me tell you about them. These are people who live in an area called Galatia, and it's in the southern part of modern Turkey. And it's a range of cities that Paul has visited. Now, interestingly, Paul has visited them, but not with the intention of staying. He actually is planning to go to the north of Turkey and again go across into Greece. But he's been held up because he's become ill. So his time in Galatia is a time when Paul is very poorly. It looks as if he's caught malaria, because at the time the coast of Turkey was covered with swamps. Mosquitoes love those kinds of areas. It looks as if he's caught malaria. And as a result of it, when he gets to the cities, he's very ill indeed. In fact, in Galatians, he says to them, I'm so glad. It doesn't actually say this in your English versions. They've sanitized it a little bit. But it actually says, I'm so glad that you didn't spit at me. That's what Paul says to the Galatians who've become Christians since he's been there. Why would they have wanted to spit at him, for goodness sake? What was wrong with him? Oh, well, that was the problem. There was something about his physical condition that made the people who were largely pagans fear that they would be contaminated by whatever had contaminated Paul. So they spit at him as a means of pushing away the evil that is obviously surrounding Paul. And Paul says, thank you that you didn't do that. And then in the very next verse, he says, you're such a great group that I know that if you could have, you would have given me your eyes instead of mine. Why would he say that? It looks as if his eyesight has been badly affected by the malaria, which happens still today. As a result of which, he has got a problem with his eyes, and the people have recognized it, and they said, oh, we'd love to give you our eyes, Paul, because we can see how difficult it is for you because of your situation. Later in other letters, by the way, you will see Paul saying things like, do you see with what large letters I'm writing to you? He's a man who is not in the perfect state of health. He is a man who knows what it is to be ill. And from time to time, these bouts of malaria will come back to him. So when he comes to the Christians, he does not come as a powerful, charismatic, dynamic person. There's a lot of weakness surrounding Paul, but still, people become Christians. Why? Because the message of the gospel is powerful, and the one who walks alongside of Paul and enables him to give this message, the Spirit, he is also powerful. Now, what Paul is going to be saying to these people is, that same Spirit who walks with me and helps me in my weakness and at times my abject weakness, that same Spirit is dedicated to you. Here's where it becomes very interesting. These people have no concept that any divine being, let alone the Holy Spirit, would want to even think about them. You see, they know who they are. The people who live in this area are almost ungovernable. The governors who were sent from Rome to govern this area tended to be those that the emperor didn't really like. He wouldn't send them here because he knew that they would be in for a tough time. They were ignorant people, pagan people, troublesome people. They were a motley crew, and they knew that of themselves, and they knew what people's perceptions were of them. They had nothing to offer of value to society, to their own communities, because they were just such a troublesome group of people. And when Paul comes to give them the gospel and says, Jesus loves you, that's shocking in itself. But then he says, now you have welcomed Jesus into your lives. Let me tell you something else. The Spirit of God, who is on the same level as Jesus, he has decided to come and live in you. And it is so shocking That's why he has to spend two chapters, the first two chapters, building up the case for why what he's about to say is true. It's authentic. It's correct. Have you got it at the end of chapter two? Yeah, we think we've got it. Right, now let me tell you what it is. So, let me take you, it's okay, I know what time we're due to end, relax. Let me take you to Galatians chapter 4, verse 6. We're just going to spend time in this verse. Galatians chapter 4, verse 6. And this is where he eventually gets to the heart of what he's saying, which is something that he will revisit in other letters to other churches, as we did yesterday when we looked at what Paul says about the Spirit in Ephesians. The Spirit is on our side, not just by our side, he's on our side, he's on your side, not just because you're in church, but because you're a child of God. Not because you're a good child of God, but because you're a child of God. He has decided to be on your side and to stay there until you go to heaven. And whilst he is by your side, he is going to be your best friend. That's his determined plan. That's his agenda. Or he may well work through you for the benefit of others. Yes, he may give you some spiritual gift, but the top of his agenda is, I want to do you good. I want you to feel safe. I want you to feel secure. I want you to know that you are unbelievably loved by God and will not be loved by God any more in a million years' time than what you are loved by God right now. And my presence with you is the seal to cement that truth. Now, what does he say in Galatians 4, verse 6? Because he's been talking about the fact that these Galatians, these people that nobody wants to own, they don't even want to own themselves sometimes because they're so ungovernable, so troublesome a group of people. Paul says, God has decided that he would like to adopt you. Really? Us? Who would want to adopt us? I could imagine them saying, we don't even want to adopt us. They say, Paul says, God has chosen to adopt you, and whether you like it or not, he has adopted you. You haven't had a part to play in the adoption process. All you've done is said, well, I'd like to follow Jesus. On the basis of that, God says, excellent, you are not just a follower of Jesus now, you are an adopted child of God. Wow, really? Absolutely. And then to build on that, Paul comes to this verse. He says, now, because you are sons, I'm going to add a little bit to Paul. I'm sure he doesn't mind this if he's listening. Because you are sons and daughters of God, because you are children of God, so on the basis that we are God's children, and God is the one who has decided that, we haven't decided that, on the basis that we are God's children, Paul says something else. What does he say? This is what my text says. God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts. Have you got something like that? On the basis of us being God's children, God has decided to do something else other than making us his children. He's going to send us the Spirit. Now, let's remember, the Spirit is not being sent by God because the Spirit is the least important in the Godhead. It's not that God and Jesus are the most important and they would prefer us to stay in heaven sitting endless cups of coffee and the Spirit is the one who has to go and do the work because he's some kind of a heavenly servant, some kind of slave to the others. Absolutely not. The Spirit is as significant as the Father, as significant as Jesus. He is as worthy of worship as the Father, as worthy of worship as Jesus. He is equivalent in terms of honor and godness as the Father and Jesus. So the Father and Jesus aren't sending the least important. They're sending one of their own. And the Spirit is not skulking around the corner hoping that he's not going to be picked for this task. He's saying, up for this, I'm up for this, I want to go. And let's not get too tied up with this. The fact that the Spirit is in you doesn't mean that it's only the Spirit in you and the Father and Jesus are somewhere else in the universe. Wherever the Spirit is, there is the Father and Jesus. Now, I don't understand how that works, but that's the truth of it. Wherever one of them is, the others are as well. So when the Spirit comes into your life, as he did at salvation, then the Father and Jesus says, we're coming as well, and in you. And in you, and in you, and in me, and in the church that's meeting on the other side of this campus. He's in each of us. But Paul's focus, just to help us with our limited intellects, he says, let me just focus on the Spirit being in you. That'll be sufficient for you to cope with. Now, the first thing he says, and I simply want to unpack this text. And what we are doing in unpacking the text is doing a couple of things. First of all, we're slowing ourselves down. And in slowing ourselves down and pausing, we're giving ourselves the opportunity to think about what Paul says. And at the same time, we're given the opportunity for the Spirit, who has authored this text, to speak to us as well. And that's what it means to walk with the Spirit that I'll mention in a few minutes' time. So in pausing, the first thing I see is that God has sent the Spirit. God has sent him. In other words, there's an authenticity about the Spirit's involvement in your life. We haven't asked the Spirit to come, and the Spirit has graciously responded. If it was we who have asked him, well, maybe the Spirit could decide to leave from time to time. But it is God who has sent him. So there is no fear in our minds that the Spirit will leave, because even if he wanted to, it's as if he couldn't, because God is the one who has initiated that process. But interestingly, Paul begins now to use some words in the Greek that don't come through in the English. So let me help you with them. When in Greek somebody wants to speak about an event in the past, they could use the past simple. If you have English teachers here, you'll know what I'm talking about. Or the past continuous. So let me give you an example. Judy and I were traveling from where we were to where we are now. It's a continuous action. Or I could have said, we traveled, almost in a moment of time. And it's the latter that Paul uses when he speaks about the Spirit being sent by the Father. In other words, he's saying it's not that the Father is sending the Spirit, and little by little, the Spirit comes, and by the time you're just about to die, then you'll have had all the Spirit. No, no, no. Paul says the Spirit has been sent, a pointing time. It's a punctilia moment. He was sent and he came. He sent him and he came into our lives in a moment of time. And he didn't come just a little bit of him or with a few of his resources. He came with all the Godhead that belongs to him. Every part of who the Spirit is came and resided with us the moment we became a Christian. Wow. You sure, Paul? You could imagine the Galatians saying, you don't quite realize who we are. Nobody wants to come and lead us because we're just such an awful bunch of people. And Paul says, I know who you are. And here's the funny thing. Well, actually not funny. Here's the remarkable thing. God knows you who you are. And he's still chosen to make you his children. And that's just the start. You see, sometimes as Christians, we've got used to the idea that being saved means, well, my sins are forgiven and I'm going to heaven. And that's it. Well, that's pretty good, but that is just the start of what salvation is about. Because salvation is intended to lead us into a relationship with God, which gets better and better and better until we're with him in the future. And on top of that, the one who makes this relationship tighter and tighter and tighter is none other than the Spirit himself, who doesn't do it from a distance, but who does it from the very heart of who we are. And God is the one who has initiated that process. And he has sent him into our lives. We never have to ask the Spirit to come into our lives or into our fellowship. He's always there. He's the God of the previous. He's the God who was there before we even thought about asking him to come. Because he's more committed to us than we are committed to him. Now, I've said that, but I almost want to question, could that be true? Could the Spirit be more committed to me than I am committed to him? I'm certainly glad that it is true. Because even when I'm there at the highest attempt of being committed to him, it's not brill. But he, as God, can only do something that's the best. And so his commitment to us is the best commitment that there can ever be. Wow. That's unbelievable. That's remarkable, which is why I've entitled that booklet, The Remarkable Spirit, but I need to move on because there's more to say. Oh, interesting. God has sent the Spirit, point in time. The description I have now of Jesus, or rather of the Spirit, is the Spirit of his Son. Have you got that in your text? God has sent the Spirit of his Son. Not the Spirit of Jesus, not the Holy Spirit, not the Holy Spirit of God, but the Spirit of his Son. Why has he used that phrase? It's the only time that Paul has used this phrase of the Holy Spirit in all of his letters. Why is he using it? It's okay, you don't have to answer. I've had a chance to think about it. Well, one of the reasons I think is because Paul wants his readers, you and them, to understand who it is that he is speaking about. He is, in effect, speaking about the Spirit who walked with Jesus. Which begs the question, why did the Spirit walk with Jesus? You remember when Jesus was baptized in water, and the voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son," and a dove landed on Jesus' head, which John tells us was a symbol of the Spirit. And the Spirit, from that moment on, right through to the end of Jesus' life, walked with him. That is not to suggest that the Spirit wasn't with Jesus for the first 30 years of his life. In fact, the Gospel of Luke tells us that when Jesus was born, the Spirit overshadowed him. So the Spirit has been present in the life of Jesus throughout his life. Why? Why is he there? And why does Jesus want us to know that the Spirit is with Jesus? And why does the Spirit want us to know that he is with Jesus? So let's think about it. Was it because Jesus needed some power to help him in his ministry? Well, possibly. But let's remember, Jesus is God. And surely to goodness, Jesus, as God, doesn't need anybody else to help him achieve what he intends to achieve, because he's God and he can do anything on his own. So if that's not why the Spirit is with Jesus, why else would the Spirit be with Jesus? Well, let me suggest to you what I think it might be. It's the Spirit's way of affirming Jesus. That's not because Jesus needs affirmation. It's not because he's a little bit trembling because of the occasion that is facing him, and there's no reason why he shouldn't be a little bit nervous, because he's going to experience things he's never experienced before. But the Spirit isn't there to affirm him as somebody who is weak and vulnerable and inadequate. He's God. The Spirit is there, in effect, to affirm him to everybody else, like you, like me, like the others. It's as if the Spirit is saying, listen, this bloke here, he just looks like an ordinary Jew. He's not an ordinary Jew. There's something special about him, and you are going to know just how special he is when you see some of the things he does, some of the words that he speaks, some of the reactions that he has, some of the emotions that he will show. And I am going to walk with him because he deserves my presence as the Spirit of God himself. In other words, Jesus has the Spirit walking with him as an affirmation to us that he is God. 3 years after Jesus first reveals himself in the River Jordan, the disciples are beginning to sense that Jesus is who Jesus truly is. But it took them 3 years to get there. But the Spirit, right from day one, has said, listen, I'm with this man. I've never been with anybody before like this, because he is unique. He's not just special. He is uniquely special, so uniquely special that I, the Spirit of God, are coming down to walk with him. Not because he's a scaredy cat who can't get through this life, but because he is a worthy being and I'm going to join with him. Now, that being the case, the Spirit of his Son, the Spirit who walks with Jesus because he is worthy of the presence of the Spirit, that same Spirit says, I'm coming to live with you. Now I say, hold on, I'm not Jesus. I don't deserve your presence. I understand that Jesus deserved your presence because he was God, but I am not God, nothing like it, never will be, and you need to reconsider whether I am a worthy candidate for your presence, because I, to be honest, don't think I am. Give me a few years to get a little better, maybe, and then you can come and meet me once a week in a coffee shop somewhere, but not to walk with me every minute of every day and night, surely to goodness. And that's why Paul has put this description in of the Spirit. He is the Spirit of Jesus, the Spirit of his Son, the Spirit who walked with Jesus, the Spirit, none other than that Spirit who committed himself to Jesus, and Jesus deserved him. That's the Spirit, Paul says, who's come to live with you. Can you imagine the Galatians who were looking around their shoulders and saying, is he all there? Does he know who he's talking to? We're Galatians, for goodness sake. We're rubbish people. We're hopeless people. We have nothing to offer. We're unskilled, ignorant, pagans, non-intellectual, non-rich. And he's telling us that the same Spirit who walked with Jesus, and Jesus was God and deserved him, that same Spirit is coming to walk with us. Can't be true, Paul. Sorry. thanks for affirming us, but you've took us to a stage that is beyond our belief. Paul's got a big job to help them realize the truth of it. And he's not yet finished the verse. This is a delightful truth, and it is a delightful truth that demands our inquiry, demands our curiosity, demands our consideration and our concentration, because it's true. And the more we realize the truth of it, what will it do? It'll do us good. It'll make us feel unbelievably loved, incredibly safe, because we know that we don't deserve the presence of the Spirit to this degree. And we know that the Spirit knows that. And we know that the Spirit knows that we know that. But the Spirit still says, I'm still coming. Still come in. Resist me all you like. Put up the barriers as to whether I should be coming into your life or not. Doesn't matter. I'm coming. Because I am more determined to affirm you than you can begin to imagine. It's the Spirit of his Son who comes into our lives. Oh, well, I say comes into our lives. Have you got where the Spirit comes in your text? It says comes into our hearts. Have you got that in your text? Yes. The Spirit comes into our hearts. Well, now, I'm a doctor, but I'm not a medical doctor, but I'm sufficiently aware of the fact that our heart, it's around about there somewhere, isn't it? Still beating, I think. There's not much room for anything else. So I'm just wondering how the Spirit can squash himself into our hearts. I'm assuming that Paul is not literally saying that the Spirit comes to live in our heart. But if he isn't speaking literally, why might he have wanted to say that the Spirit is coming into our hearts? Why not just saying the Spirit is coming into our lives or into our bodies or into our beings? Why does he say the Spirit is coming into our hearts? In fact, why does he say that God has directed the Spirit to come into our hearts? What's so special about the heart as to be the residence of the Spirit? And again, we have to put our first century hats on to understand this, because otherwise we'll misunderstand it. You see, for you and me, the heart is the place of affection. It's the place of romance, the place of love. It's those kinds of happy emotions. That's not how the first century ancient Near Eastern people thought of the heart. They did think the heart symbolized something, but they thought the heart symbolized the very center of your being. The very heart of who you were was best defined as the heart. They did have a part of the body that they associated with affection and romance and love, and that was actually the bowels, the intestines, which doesn't quite work in a 21st century context. I love you, Judy, with all my intestines. I'm not overly sure she's going to be keen on that. Love you with all my bowels, darling. That's just to assess the height of my love. Now, the first century people, the heart for them was not associated with the place of love and emotions and affection. It was the very center of who you were. Now, we may decide that the heart of who we were, the center of who we might say, well, actually, it's our brain. That's what gives us the character or the personality of who we are. We might use a different part of the body. But for them, they had identified it as the heart. So now hear what Paul is saying, because he knows that his readers understand the symbolic value of the heart. He knows that what they will understand when he says that the Spirit is coming into their hearts is that the Spirit is coming into the most central part of who they are, going into the most central part of their lives. It's not good enough for Paul to say that the Spirit is coming into the world. It's not good enough for him to say that the Spirit is coming to stand here, or even to come into our bodies or into our lives. He says, no, the Spirit is coming into the very center of who you are. Why is he there? Is it to check up on us so that he'll realize all the things that we've thought we're going to say tomorrow that are wrong before we even got there? No, no, no. He is coming into the very center of our being because it's there that he can best influence us. It's there that he can best relate to us. It's there that he can make a biggest impact on who we are, because his desire in coming into our lives is not just to passively be there, but it is to dynamically interact with us as we are. And where can he do that? From what position can he do that the best? It's the very center of who we are. And in that world, it's the heart. So what have we got in this little verse that we have slowly unpacked? And we haven't finished it yet, but we're getting there. Because you are children of God, that's the bottom line. Because you are children of God, that's the start to something else remarkable. God has chosen to send, and actually he uses a different word for send. He actually says, has sent out. It's as if, the picture is if the Spirit has been sent out of the Godhead. It's as if he's saying, well now, the Spirit who used to be with me and Jesus is now being delegated to another family, you. He's been sent out of us to go to you. It's a picture. It's not meant to be literally understood because you cannot separate the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. But it's a picture that Paul wants us to conjure with, to enjoy, that the Spirit is as if the Spirit is saying, now here's it. It's as if the Spirit is saying, I'm closer to you than I am to the Father. It's not literally to, but it's as if I'm closer to you than I am to Jesus. I've been sent out from the Father. They have delegated me to you. This is the remarkably elevated status of the child of God. And then he says, oh, by the way, let me just remind you who this Spirit is. He's the Spirit who chose to walk with Jesus. And remember, he chose to walk with Jesus because Jesus deserved his presence. Oh, well, that rules him out from walking with me then. Oh, no, funnily enough, it doesn't. Because he knows who you are and he still chooses to walk with you in the same capacity as he walked with Jesus. You hear that? It's the same capacity as the way he walked with Jesus. Remember when Jesus says to the disciples, he says, I'm leaving you. And they're shocked and heartbroken. But he says, it's okay. I'm going to send another advocate who is going to function exactly the same as me. He's not a second best than me. He's going to be as good as me. And he's speaking about the Spirit. And Paul picks up the same theme. And that Spirit comes and lives in the very center of who we are, into our hearts. And what's he there to do? This is where Paul finishes this verse. He is there to remind us that it is appropriate to say Abba, Father. Abba is simply the Aramaic word for Father. It's nothing particularly spiritually special. It's just an Aramaic word, and many of these people would have spoken Aramaic. The Spirit gives us the confidence that we can actually say to God, you are my Father. Now, remember these people, they feel orphaned by their community. They feel abandoned by their society, and they have every reason to assume that it is right for their society to abandon them because they're not worthy of being called sons and daughters. And when they come to God, the creator of the universe, they're going to bring that package with them of uncertainty and confidence. And Paul says, listen, don't worry, because there are times when you're going to just feel so presumptuous in assuming that God is your Father. Listen, somebody has come alongside of you, and one of his main reasons for being there is to remind you that you are the child of God. And when you can't articulate that word yourself, just listen to him, pumping the truth into your heart. You are a child of God. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. And remember who it is he's telling you. It's God, and he never makes mistakes, and he knows the truth about everything. That's why the Spirit is in our lives. Now, maybe the Spirit will use us this week to do something for him. Well, that's great, but never lose sight of the fact that the agenda of the Spirit is fundamentally to do you good. The last thing I want to say, and it's again in Galatians, but I just want to flick you over into the next chapter, because on the basis of this, Paul uses a very interesting term with reference to the Spirit. I'm in verse 16, and Paul says, in effect, after all I've said about the Spirit's functioning in your life, what I want you to do, verse 16, is walk by the Spirit, or walk with the Spirit. He uses a very interesting term for this walk. I'd ask Judy to stand up, but I won't embarrass her, so you'll just have to imagine that Judy is by my side. The word that he is using for walk is that which you see soldiers doing when they march in unison together. Left foot forward, right foot forward, left foot forward, right foot forward. What Paul is doing, he's taking a military term for walking, and he is saying, now that's what the Spirit would like you to do with him. When he takes a step there, you take a step there. When you take a step here, when he takes a step here, you take a step here. Now, he's not asking that you function as soldiers or be enslaved to the patterning of what the Spirit is wanting to do, but he's wanting to lift us up to recognize that we do have the privilege of walking with the Spirit, who, after all, has created the universe with the Father and the Son. And he says, no, you can join. You can join with what the Father and the Son and I am doing, because we are in unison, and you can come and join us. You can be in unison together. You can walk with me. Question is, how do we walk with the Spirit? Because I can't see him. I don't know where his left foot has been. Well, he hasn't got any feet, has he? He's a spirit. How do I know how to walk with the Spirit? Well, one of the ways we can do it is what we've just done. We have explored a little verse, and we've slowed ourselves down, and we have asked questions of the text. We've asked questions, if you like, of the human author. And as we have paused and considered and thought, we have found that we have encountered the Spirit as well, because we have been hearing what the Spirit has been saying to us through the words of the human author, Paul. And the message, if I needed a message for this talk, it would be the Spirit's agenda is to include us. That's his agenda, is to include us, to affirm us, to make us secure and safe. How do I know that? I've just read a verse from a book that was written 2,000 years ago. Ah, yes, but I've slowed down, unpacked it, and I've been giving myself the opportunity to recognize that these are not just the intellectual words of a clever man called Paul, but he is inspired by the Spirit to relay a truth to me, to you, to us, that same Spirit loves to include. And to include in an inclusive way that is completely exclusive to those who call themselves the children of God. That's you and that's me. So walking with God, we can do it every day when we read the Bible. Just slow down and say, you're trying to tell me something here. Ask questions of the text and see what answers you might receive when you do it. Well, I'm done. Which is kind of a way of saying amen. But before I hand back to the musicians, I think, yes? Yep. Let me pray. Father, I'd like to thank you for the remarkable truth that we've been exploring. If it was left to us to try and identify your relationship with us, we would never, in a million years, assume that your walk with us was ever intended to be as close as it truly is. We would have probably ended up with assuming that you would have been happy to have talked to us once in a blue moon, and even then, perhaps, as part of a crowd. But here you are revealing to us your true heart, which is to embrace us as individuals in a very personal, inimitable way. And thank you, Spirit, that you participate in that journey, because there are times when we doubt it, and doubt whether we could think of ourselves in that close relationship to our God. Thank you, Spirit, for taking it upon yourself to remind us practically, actively, of the reality. Thank you so much. Amen.